Welcome to Talk Nation Radio. I'm Dori Smith. Our one-hour special focuses exclusively on a 39-year-old Georgia man seeking a last-minute stay of execution with only hours to go before the state carries out what will likely be the death by lethal injection of an innocent man. Troy Anthony Davis was given an execution date of Tuesday, September 23, 2008, at 7 p.m., unless his defense team can get the Georgia Board of Pardons and Parole to reverse a decision they made September 12th not to give Davis clemency. And we're going to be providing information from Amnesty International about how to help Troy Davis.
And we're trying to ask the Georgia Board of Pardons and Parole to live up to what they have promised in the past, that being that they would never execute anybody if there was any doubt of their guilt.
There have been a lot of exonerations, some of them through DNA, but what caused the mistake in the first place wasn't DNA, it was something like a faulty eyewitness.
We're joined by Richard Dieter of the Death Penalty Information Office in Washington, D.C., and he'll be going over problems that are inherent to the judicial process involving capital crimes. And Robert Nave of Amnesty International's Program to Abolish the Death Penalty and the Connecticut Network to Abolish the Death Penalty will be telling us specifically about more of the details of the case of Troy Davis. The Davis case has led death penalty abolitionists and supporters of the Davis family to put their lives on hold, taking emergency measures and reaching out to whoever will listen to try to prevent a gross injustice. Some are against the death penalty on moral grounds. Others say America's judicial system has put too many people on death row unfairly. And at this point, 130 people have been released from death row after new evidence cleared them. Attorneys familiar with the Troy Davis case say the name Troy Davis should be added to that list. Davis has been on death row for 17 years for a total of 19 years in prison. And after spending decades waiting for news that there was new evidence to clear him, Davis and his supporters have been frustrated to find that new evidence but be unable to use much of it due to frustrating legal constraints. There was no physical evidence in the Davis case. The state made a case based entirely on the testimony of witnesses. And of the 9 witnesses, 7 have recanted their testimony to the point of signing admissions that they were guilty of perjury. At a 2007 clemency hearing in Georgia, Davis was given more time. But his September 12th hearing before Georgia's Board of Pardons and Paroles led to a shocking disappointment. Despite new admissions about the case, shocking testimony from witnesses, and despite even state Supreme Court judges arguing there is simply not enough evidence to show Troy Davis committed the crime of murder in the death of a young police officer named Mark Allen McPhail, the board denied Davis clemency. One after another witness testified that they had been under pressure at the trial, and key witnesses have created a clear picture of what happened on the night McPhail was shot and killed while trying to help a homeless man. In fact, the man this officer helped in the parking lot of a fast food restaurant has told the Board of Pardons and Parole that it was not Troy Davis who shot the police officer, but in fact one of the other witnesses, Sylvester or Red Coles. Let's listen now to the voice of Troy Anthony Davis. This was recorded by D.C. Radio Co-op and Free Speech Radio News reporter Naji Mohadid at the prison.
I just want to tell everybody how thankful I am for their prayers, their support, and want them to continue to stand up because anybody can be put in my particular situation. It's time for the young brothers out there in the street to do what's right, to educate themselves and their younger brothers and teach them how to turn their life around in the right direction, open up your own businesses, make sure that you got yourself in check so that you will have a better chance in life to survive and won't be a part of the system. It's time for the sisters to embrace their brothers, the ones that are doing wrong, to talk to them, to encourage them to do right. But most of all, it's time for people in general to stand up for everything that they feel is not right and to speak out and let their voice be heard. My situation is a situation that should have never happened. But together, if we pull together as a people, I'll be coming home. And when I come home, we can bring more brothers and sisters out, bring them home, gather together, and as one people, we can make a change in this wicked world.
That audio tape of Troy Davis aired on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, for a lot more coverage on the Troy Davis story. Amnesty International USA has set up a special page, amnestyusa.org/Troy Davis, for those wishing to fax letters of final appeal. After sending letters, Amnesty is hoping people will also call the board directly at 404-651-6671 or use cell phones to help spread the word by texting Troy to 90999. Other information on how to help with calls and letters is available by placing the words Troy Anthony Davis in your URL banner, troyanthonydavis.org. Countless human rights activists and religious leaders have written letters in support of Troy Davis, including former President Jimmy Carter, Pope Benedict, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and even former FBI Director William Sessions. He's not opposed to the death penalty, but he's looked at this case and feels there's not enough evidence to execute Troy Davis. Richard Dieter is Executive Director of the Death Penalty Information Center, and you can go to their webpage, deathpenaltyinfo.org, to learn more about the 130 cases of death row prisoners released after new evidence was brought to light. I asked Richard Dieter to talk about what the defense for Troy Anthony Davis has been trying to do in proving his innocence under conditions they're working under within the Georgia legal system.
The issue of innocence is, strange as it seems, it's somewhat of a new one for the courts. I mean, obviously, trial courts determine guilt or innocence, but appeals courts have steered away from that issue because they say that's a question of fact. Juries decide that. We decide whether you had a fair trial. If you had a fair trial, that is, you had a lawyer, you had a judge, then the conviction stands. We're not going to redetermine it. But things are changing on that score with the advent of DNA and other scientific testing that says even though you had a fair trial, even though your conviction has been upheld, sometimes the system gets it wrong. In this case, I don't think there is any DNA evidence that would prove things one way or the other. But there is doubt, and it's still possible for a court, even the U.S. Supreme Court, to say at times the evidence of innocence or the throwing of doubt on the conviction of guilt rises to a certain point that it just would be unconstitutional to execute this person. You know, the risks and it's a cost-benefit sort of thing. The cost is the person's life, possibly an innocent person. Delay to have a hearing on this or further review, let's interview each of these witnesses, put them in testimony and under oath in a hearing. That's some cost, but compared to the cost of an innocent person, it's relatively small. So I'd have to say that the windows are closing on this case. They've tried a number of avenues, but as long as an execution hasn't occurred, courts sometimes will agree to take a second look. I'm sure the lawyers are filing motions, and even the Board of Pardons could say that, you know, maybe there's something new that they hadn't considered before. So, you know, there's still possible ways this case could get delayed. It is true that it's getting close and some of the courts have already turned him down.
And what we know at this point is that the man who was attacked, Officer McPhail trying to help him, has said a different person was the one who shot McPhail. And then there was another witness who overheard Mr. Coles confessing to the crime, as I understand it. This testimony being rejected by a judge who calls it hearsay?
I don't know all the facts of that, but I that does sound like an objection that would be raised. I mean, you can say what you saw, but to say someone else said something, that's sort of the good example of what would be hearsay. But, you know, again, when innocence and possible mistaken execution is on the line, sometimes a court will want to hear all the evidence. It's not like it's before a jury. You have to worry when you're before a jury about hearsay. Judges can consider, parole boards can consider things that would be outside of the usual evidence. But on the other hand, the courts, you know, do take this reverse approach in these cases, whereas at trial you're assumed to be innocent and proven guilty. Once you've got that conviction, there's a reluctance to change it to the assumption is you are now guilty and you're going to have to, do a very high level of proof to show you're innocent. And that's the problem he faces. I think he's already, or his lawyers, have already established what many people would say are reasonable doubts. But it's now later in the game, and courts are saying you have to show something almost like scientific evidence, almost like foolproof evidence that you didn't do it. And, you know, that's, I think, the problem with the death penalty, that it once it starts, once it gets on track towards an execution, it's very hard to derail, and mistakes could be made.
There have been a lot of people exonerated through DNA evidence, but is it too late now? I mean, the murder was 19 years ago.
Yeah, I don't think that DNA evidence is probably going to be, you know, either it's been lost, contaminated, simply doesn't exist. Nowadays, they might preserve things, but 20 years ago, 19 years ago, they weren't as focused on that. Or you know, and some crimes just don't have DNA evidence that could be used. This is more of a credibility, more of a, eyewitnesses. There have been a lot of exonerations, and some of them through DNA. But what caused the mistake in the first place wasn't DNA. It was something like a faulty eyewitness. People with the best of intentions sometimes say, they look at some pictures of suspects and they say, I think it was him. But that's a sketchy science at best, and faulty eyewitness is one of the main reasons for wrongful conviction. So I think there's every reason to believe that a mistake could have been made in this case, and now we have not one but multiple witnesses who have said that they were not as sure, or they weren't, you know, they were pressured. They simply would not have pointed to Troy Davis at this point. That's a lot of change. That's why I think this case is so unusual. Not one witness, it's seven.
You know, you hear all kinds of stories about people in prisons, and it's hard to really understand why America has so many prisoners in general. I think we've now beaten the former Soviet Union in the arrest, the number of people we simply have in prison here. But beyond that, is there anything special about Georgia? This case where this man has spent 19 years of his life incarcerated seems to indicate that maybe there is something important about Georgia's legal system and also their review system. Because as I understand it, first of all, the governor can't pardon this prisoner even if he wanted to, right?
That's right. I think this stems from some abuses within the pardon system in the past. But in any case, there is an unusual system. In most states, the governor, either with the consent of the board or consulting with the board or by himself or herself, can make the decision. Here, it's the board that makes the decision completely. And Georgia has been unusually tough. I mean, Georgia was one of the leading execution states earlier in the 20th century. Things slowed down a bit, but of late, they were the first state to execute somebody this year after lethal injection was approved by the U.S. Supreme Court. They have just the other day executed a man, Jack Alderman, who was on death row for 33 years and was a model prisoner. His co-defendant, who also committed the murder, only got 12 years in prison. You know, a lot of reasons why he should have been commuted, and he wasn't. So there seems to be right now a push on the death penalty in Georgia that is somewhat surprising. I mean, they have more executions this year than they've had in the past. I don't know why exactly that's happening, but it's not just Troy Davis's case.
Is there a possibility that the state has some figures in it involved in the death penalty? I know there's a prosecutor here who has been strongly in favor of executing Troy Davis. I think it's David Locke is his name. And is it possible that any figures in the system like David Locke or others might want to hurry up and do some executions, set a precedent before the election of November changes the staff in the White House?
Well, you know, I don't know enough to impute a motive, but I do know that the death penalty is often used politically. There's vast discretion about who to pursue, death penalty cases against. What we've seen is that if a white person is murdered, you're much more likely to get the death penalty. And that was a study was done in Georgia One of the most comprehensive studies ever was done in Georgia. Matter of fact, it went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it was like four times more likely that you would get the death penalty if the victim was white. And there's political sides to that. That's the community that, you know, may be voting, may be contributing more or has, you know, more power or whatever. So those murders are somehow worse. Well, that's, you know, that's an arbitrary or unfair basis. But if you look across the country, choices are made about who to seek the death penalty against, even who gets executed among the people on death row, and when those happen. States can slow down or they can speed up, and it's not a uniform process. And yes, the political leaders have some control over all of that. I don't know what's going on in particular in Georgia. This is a case, you know, been brewing for a while, but judges run for office sometimes, promising to be tough on the death penalty. Prosecutors certainly do that, but judges, you know, should be more on the even side, and that injects a level of partisanship into something that's supposed to be just the criminal justice system, you know, working fairly.
I wonder, Richard Dieter, if you're going to have members of Congress at some point reviewing the case of Troy Anthony Davis if he is executed and finding that the evidence was, you know, in favor of giving him clemency and using this case as an example for new laws in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, that may be the only positive thing that comes out if he is executed. I think this case is going to remain as one that maybe should have some more courage or, stepping in to stop this should have been happening. And it'll be a tragedy if now, you know, 6 months from now, even stronger evidence comes out and two more people or you know, someone else confesses, or things could happen still on this case that, you know, could make it an embarrassment. I think there's already been enough evidence to say this should be slowed down, examined, perhaps commuted, whatever the solution would be to avoid the tragedy. But so far the side seems to be locked into moving ahead with the execution. But there's still federal courts. There's still possibilities for change here.
Well, Richard Dieter, thank you so much for joining us to talk about your legal work and the project that you have online. Can you tell people how they can get in touch with you and what's on your website?
Sure. We have a very extensive website on all aspects of the death penalty at deathpenaltyinfo.org. You know, and our contact information is all there, too. So if you're interested in this issue, I hope you go there.
Richard Dieter is Executive Director of the Death Penalty Information Center. I'm Dori Smith with a special edition of Talk Nation Radio. TalkNationRadio.org to follow this story. And so it is again a countdown to September 23rd at 7 p.m. for those who care deeply about Troy Davis. One of them is Robert Nave of Amnesty International's Program to Abolish the Death Penalty and the Connecticut Network to Abolish the Death Penalty. And these organizations and the ACLU have been coordinating a petition. There have been some 200,000 signatures at this point. I really don't know how many there have been. Before we turn to our conversation with Robert Nave, let me say once again, Amnesty International USA's special website is at amnestyusa.org/Troy Davis. For those wishing to fax letters of final appeal, these would go to the Board of Pardons and Parole. After sending letters, Amnesty is hoping people will also call the board directly at the number 404-651-6671. There are other numbers available online, and you can also use your cell phone to help spread the word. Text TROY to 90999. That's TROY to 90999. There's also other information available on how to help with calls and letters by placing the words Troy Anthony Davis in your URL banner. It's troyanthonydavis.org. Let's turn now to Robert Nave. Mr. Nave, I know you're very familiar with this case. You know the Davises. What do you think Georgia's legal system came up with as a motive for Troy Davis? I mean, he seems like a very kind-hearted person. He's got a lot of faith in God. I just can't really follow the logic that he was a killer even 19 years ago. I know people change, but was there any accusation about a motive?
It's interesting, and the way prosecutions work, and oftentimes it is backwards, oftentimes the investigators will draw a conclusion prior to getting the evidence, and there was tremendous pressure in Savannah, Georgia, to find the perpetrator of the crime. And as the case unfolded, a few things indicated that they should start looking towards the direction of Troy. And so the police went on the assumption that Troy was the guilty party, and they built a case around that. And slowly over the weeks, they built the case and found people that would swear to that it was Troy. It has since come to light that the methods the police used were at the least heavy-handed and at the most possibly even criminal. In one case, when they were pressuring for the third time one of Troy's friends to say that Troy did it, they threw down a newspaper in front of the young man, who was, I think, 18 at the time, threw down a newspaper in front of him, and the headline said, "Shoot to Kill," on the front page, and they said, "We want to get Troy Davis for this, so you have to tell us what you know," and in effect, they were threatening him, and he caved. He caved into the pressure. There were other people who were fearful of the person who everybody has indicated since is the perpetrator of this crime, and they were fearful of him and of repercussions, and so the police were able to build a case based on all these factors, and unfortunately, that was the case here, and there is strong evidence now to suggest Troy's absolute innocence in this case.
Now, the case is pending in the U.S. Supreme Court, right? And then there is a last-minute, really, effort to try to get a stay of execution again, and this would be, though, from the Board of Pardons that has just refused to give him clemency.
Right.
I want to talk about that Board of Pardons.
Yes.
This board is appointed by the governor. In this case, we don't know how many members have been appointed by Sonny Perdue, right?
Right. Right. I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, the Attorney General's office couldn't tell me. They think he may have appointed some members, but they were not sure.
Right.
So I'll try to find that out. I have a call into Sonny Perdue's office, but they have not yet gotten back to me. Now, in the situation in Georgia, though, you have five people. They don't necessarily need to be judges. They
That's
don't
correct.
Necessarily need to be lawyers.
Right.
And yet they find whether or not a person lives or dies in these matters.
Right. Well, Connecticut has the same thing. We have a Board of Pardons and Parole. It's a very similar structure here in Connecticut as it is in New Jersey, taking away any authority to grant clemency from the governor. The governor has no authority in these matters. The Board of Pardons and Parole has final authority in such matters. And oftentimes, yes, they are not necessarily legal experts or law enforcement experts, and they do have final say in such matters. That is correct.
It sounds as if one of the problems in this case is that they're talking about testimony in the matter of evidence that was used to convict Troy Davis.
Right.
The only evidence was, you know, witnesses who said they saw this.
Right.
And now, I just want to say, and now one of the things that's going on is that it sounds like they're saying now that someone who has come forward to say it was not Troy Davis, it was Coles, who actually is one of the witnesses.
Right.
They're saying that that's hearsay?
Well, unfortunately, once a case is adjudicated, once the jury has come back with a decision of guilty, a verdict of guilty, in effect, whatever the prosecution puts forward as the truth becomes truth. That is accepted as the truth. And everything after that is then viewed as speculation or hearsay. The sad fact, though, there were nine people who testified against Troy. Seven of the nine have fully recanted and implicated Sylvester Coles. And the only two left, one was not able to be gotten for this, and the other one was Sylvester Coles himself, and he's not going to testify against himself. And that's the amazing thing about this case. There is not one shred of physical evidence that connects Troy Davis to this case. It all centers on eyewitness testifying, eyewitness identification, And the thing about eyewitness identification that many people are not aware of is that is the weakest form of evidence to produce in trial, because people are often mistaken as to what they see, or they're traumatized, or they forget. And the idea that solely eyewitnesses who have now all recanted said that Troy did it indicates the level of pressure exerted on these people in the initial trial to point to Troy Davis when, again, there is absolutely no physical evidence. And some of the testimony is striking in its glaring proof or indication of proof that Troy most certainly is innocent. And personally, my most striking, again, to use the word, moment was when the person who was assaulted that caused Officer McPhail to come running onto the scene testified to the Board of Pardons and Parole. He was very clear that he has maintained all along that the person who hit him was the person who shot the officer. And he has maintained all along that the person who hit him was Sylvester Coles. And that, for some reason, never made it into trial, and that has not been viewed as evidence. And he is saying it now very clearly, very publicly, but since Troy has had his proverbial day in court, that will never be heard in evidence.
Listeners can go to the website TroyAnthonyDavis.org for some gripping stories about this case, including an overview of events on the night that Officer McPhail was shot. Again, the website TroyAnthonyDavis.org. We're speaking with Robert Nave of the Connecticut Network to Abolish the Death Penalty. I'm Dory Smith. We'll be back on Monday, the 22nd, to go over this case once again and air some further aspects of the story between 3 and 4 p.m. at FM 91.7 in Connecticut or WHUS.org online. Our website is TalkNationRadio.org for further information. The only evidence in this case, the testimony of people who mostly now have recanted their testimony from earlier years. And it's just been amazing to see the story develop and how new evidence has come forward that could clear Troy Davis, but it may never be heard in a court of law. But I believe no gun was ever found in this case, right?
And in terms of the gun being found, there was testimony at the Board of Pardons and Parole hearing in July of 2007, where people came forward and said the gun that was used at that crime was placed inside their apartment by Sylvester Coles. He stuck his head in the apartment, threw it in the door, and went running. And it was later retrieved by them, and then it's gone. So there is some evidence to indicate that the weapon that was used was seen at some point in time. And yes, there's no gun, no record of Troy having a gun, no fingerprints, nothing to indicate that he did this.
There's only so many hours left. It's a countdown, really, to save Troy's life. And where do things stand now in terms of what can work?
I have been in the anti-death penalty business long enough to know that anything can happen. You really never know what's going to happen. We are making massive appeals to the Georgia Board of Pardons and Parole. Tens of thousands of people are contacting them. We have, once again, representative and civil rights icon John Lewis, who's spoken on Troy's behalf. We have former President Jimmy Carter, who has today issued a statement calling for clemency for Troy Davis. We have people from around the world. The Pope has weighed in on the issue, obviously. And we're trying to ask the Georgia Board of Pardons and Parole to live up to what they have promised in the past, that being that they would never execute anybody if there was any doubt of their guilt. And I believe we have shown more than any doubt. I think we have shown that there is considerable doubt, not only to his participation in this, but as to his actual innocence to this. So we must continue to apply great public pressure for the Georgia Board of Pardons and Parole to reverse their decision and to basically follow their own rules.
You mentioned the Pope. As I called to get information about this story, I spoke with some officials in Georgia. And I will just tell people, I contacted the governor's office, I contacted the attorney general's office, and I contacted about two more official locations in the state of Georgia that could have any bearing on this case. This is what I was told. The governor's office can't pardon anyone.
Right.
The attorney general doesn't take a position in this type of matter. And finally, in terms of Congress, they're mostly, as I look at their web pages, looking at the matter of energy and trying to advocate for offshore drilling in places like Alaska, which has nothing to do with Georgia.
Right.
One person in one of these offices, when I mentioned the fact that the Vatican had sent a letter, they said, well, it was a form letter, the same kind, you know, that everyone gets, apparently.
Right.
So they discounted that a letter from the Vatican or Pope Benedict meant anything. They also discounted the idea that a letter from Jimmy Carter meant anything. And what they said was, well, their weighing in, as you put it, is more or less a matter of course in cases like this, or it's been done before.
Mm-hmm.
So that really kind of, I think, it almost makes it seem trivial.
Yes, in some ways, I think, again, this is now a battle of public perception. Unfortunately, we have seemingly forgotten that the idea of justice is really what we should be searching for, and the officials in Georgia are faced with a situation which they must be very uncomfortable with. They are faced with the potential of executing an innocent man, and if Troy Davis is in fact innocent, that would be obviously unbelievably unforgivable if they do execute him. And then furthermore, the world was basically telling them don't. So they've backed themselves into a corner, and we are trying to offer them the solution, which is clemency for Troy Davis. And I believe any reasoned individual, regardless of their position on the death penalty, would understand the gravity of the situation, thus precipitating the letters from people like the Pope and Jimmy Carter and Congressman John Lewis. These are not standard letters, and this is not a standard case. So the idea of anybody trying to trivialize these things really is, I think, just a defense mechanism in recognition of the gravity of the situation.
One person told me that there's a difference between what advocates like your organization have been saying about this case and what is being said about witness statements.
Yeah.
And what he was driving at wasn't to try to discredit the witnesses that have come forward and recanted. He was saying more that there could be a legalese here.
Oh, yes.
That would prevent any of the normal, you know, processes to go forward. And now
right.
There are evidently rules that apply
absolutely
to people recanting their testimony.
Mm-hmm.
This testimony, though, was recanted not that long after the trial, but evidently Davis didn't have the kind of defense where people tracked this kind of thing and,
right.
and presented it earlier, right?
Right.
So it's not like these people recanted after 19 years. They came forward much earlier,
some
of them.
And furthermore, the points made are true. There are legal precedents as to when things happen and when things could be shown as such. But just because there are legal things that might be barriers doesn't change the fact that Georgia is likely going to execute a very potentially innocent person. And the fact that the procedure is legal doesn't make the outcome right. And, you know, at one point in time in the South, slavery was legal. It doesn't make it right. This procedure is legal, but it is wrong. And so I don't really hold much trust in anybody saying, well, the legal procedures were followed. Well, that may be so. But it still doesn't make the actions correct. But that is, unfortunately, how many people are proceeding with this case, which is why in the United States, we oftentimes hear of cases like this where innocent people are convicted and sent to prison, and I am convinced that we have actually executed a number of innocent people because of such legalese.
I think it's 130 now.
As of yesterday.
That were exonerated, many of them spent decades in prison.
That is correct.
130 people on death row.
Right.
Found innocent.
And what amazes me is the same period of time in which 130 people have been exonerated, we have executed about 1,100 people. And I always, when I speak in public, I always say it's as if every time you fly on a jumbo jet, they welcome you aboard saying, 9 out of 10 times we make it, on the 10th time the plane is going to crash and burn. That's the record of our judicial system when it comes to the death penalty. 1,100 executions, 130 exonerations. This is just amazing that we are entrusting such a grave situation to people who get it wrong so often. And personally speaking, I always second-guess the government in how they tax me. I always look carefully. I don't even trust the government to plow my roads correctly. And we're entrusting a government to have a system that is infallible so that we never execute an innocent person. That's just not going to happen.
One of the people who wanted to stay off the record that I talked with, but who is in one of the official offices I mentioned, said that it struck him that, you know, in this particular case, they're trying to prove innocence. And they're not looking for a technicality in the trial. They're not looking for any other reason to grant clemency based on who Troy Davis is, but rather are looking to free him as if trying the evidence again before the Georgia Board of Pardons and Parole. Does that strike you as at all relevant to this conversation, or do you think that's a deflection of the subject?
I definitely think it's a deflection of the subject, but there is some truth to the matter. But what it reflects is not our advocacy. What it reflects is the problem with the system. Our system is so flawed that new evidence that can prove somebody's innocence can be withheld from courts through the entire appellate process. And that's being illustrated in this case. What people need to realize is that once a jury comes back with that guilty verdict, all the evidence presented to get to that verdict becomes rock-solid fact. And appeals look at procedures, not evidence. And so when a person gets an appeal, they get an appeal based on procedure, where all procedures followed, where the laws followed as to how the trials were run. There is never a repeat of the evidence in front of a court. And in the case of Troy Davis, all the new evidence has come forward since trial, but since no court has ever had the ability to look at this and refuses to look at this, as the Georgia Supreme Court did in a sharply divided decision, 4-3, this past spring, we have no choice but to go in front of the Board of Pardons and Parole. As a matter of fact, I would welcome a new evidentiary hearing and a new trial, because the evidence now would strongly indicate Troy's innocence and somebody else's guilt. And in all this, we also seem to forget that if Troy did not do this, and the evidence seems to suggest it, the actual murderer of a police officer is free and walking our streets.
What about Troy Davis's family? They must be going through hell right now.
And, you know, this is the thing. This is a lose-lose-lose situation. And I could go on with the lose. The public loses because this is not good public policy. We lose tremendous amount of resources that should be going to other programs. The family of Officer McPhail lose because they have to suffer through this time and time again. Regardless of their position on the death penalty, they have to endure this. And then, of course, Troy is suffering, and Troy's family is suffering. And yes, they have gone through a lot, just like everybody else in this. I also worry about the judge and the jury in the initial case. I don't know how people could live with themselves knowing that the decision that they made will result in the death of somebody else. And as I've been working carefully and closely on this case for years, I myself find myself extremely upset as the date approaches. And I have lived long enough so that people have died who I have known. And I remember when my father was terminal with cancer, we knew it was day to day, but the exact time we never quite knew. And I was just thinking about that today. I know Troy, I know his family, and we know the exact time and moment he is going to die. And not only do we know that, we know that a government is sanctioning his murder. This is legalized murder that we will have to sit and watch, and there's nothing that we could do but go forward with our public attempt to persuade the Georgia Board of Pardons and Parole to stop this barbaric process.
An appeal has been filed for another stay of execution in the state of Georgia. Does that have a chance at all?
Well, I never want to say that things don't have a chance. Obviously, things are not looking good. The United States Supreme Court is not in session. They are constitutionally mandated to begin their session the first Monday in October. And I believe the fact that this execution is being pushed through rapidly, we did not expect an execution date yet. We expected one in October or November, is indicative of the fact that Georgia is trying to get this done quickly and sort of sweep it under the carpet, so to speak. So I'm dismayed that they're doing this prior to the Supreme Court of the United States convening. So yeah, there is little hope for intervention somewhere.
And I just want to talk about the media for a minute, because in some of these cases where people were later found innocent, one of the big factors was that media attention was brought to bear, timed in such a way that they just had their lives saved. And that, I think, is worth mentioning, because in this kind of a case, if Troy Davis has enough time, he might well be able to save his own life through the evidence that's been provided.
Yes.
Just comment on the state both of the media and then also what special factors are brought to bear because of the Bush administration. They've had a huge impact on the judicial system, and I just wondered about the whole issue of habeas corpus, which is a matter at stake here.
Well, there's a lot to answer there. As for habeas corpus, that is obviously a huge topic, and I'm tempted to say another topic for another day, because my primary concern when it comes to death penalty cases is more with the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act that was passed, I believe it was 1995, and Joe Biden was one of the authors of that. And that in itself cut enormous steps out of the death penalty process, trying to streamline and make more effective a death penalty. And I believe when the law was written, we had 30 or 40 people exonerated from death rows, and that's risen by almost 100 cents. So I don't know what is effective. It's effective that it's lousing up the system more is the only thing I could come up with. So the idea of the death penalty being a political football is absolutely true. Unfortunately, it is poor public policy. It diverts resources. It does not protect us. It does not make police safer on the streets. If anything, I'd like to see the death penalty taken away and all the extra money that's spent on it, which is in the hundreds of millions of dollars per year, extra spent on death cases, give that to law enforcement and let them have better enforcement on the streets, bulletproof vests for all officers, two police officers on shift at night in the big cities, things that could prevent crime as well. And when it comes to the media, I believe that the media is vital. It's, you know, the fourth estate is extremely important. The media has been essential in helping exonerate people. There was a flurry of exonerations in Illinois. And most of those came about because of students in a journalism class at Northwestern, if I remember correctly. And all those exonerations in Illinois led Governor Ryan, a Republican — this is not a Republican or Democrat issue either, but he was a Republican and a firm supporter of the death penalty — this led Governor Ryan to put a halt to all executions in Illinois until they could study it, because when he was about to sign his first death warrant, he realized there had been 12 executions in Illinois and 13 exonerations, and he recognized the system is broken. And they researched, and the commission in Illinois recommended that the death penalty be abolished. And as Justice Blackmun stated in 1992, I will no longer tinker with the machinery of death. And that's what we are doing. We are trying to fix a system that is irreparably broken, and we are doing it on the lives of the innocent and on the backs of the taxpayers. And the media is essential in carrying that message forward.
One of those exonerated in Illinois was Anthony Porter. And I guess this was back in the late 90s. He had been on death row for decades, too. And evidently, just days before he was set to die, there were people who were researching, and they finally evidently came up with evidence. I wonder how they managed to get it to the courts in time. But, you know, in this case, as I'm looking now at Russ Feingold's discussion of this that's available in a speech he gave in 2000 to Columbia University School of Law, he said, a study in 1987 found that between 1900 and 1985, 350 people convicted of capital crimes in the U.S. were innocent of the crimes found. Mm-hmm. I imagine reviewing all of those cases from back in the 1900s must have been pretty tough. But still, it's compelling evidence that the system doesn't work, and that the capital cases are the ones that you should look at the evidence most closely, right?
Right.
Now, let's look at Georgia in particular. In a lot of states, the governor can step in, or someone else with expertise in the law, such as the attorney general, might be able to step in. I don't know all states' laws, but in Georgia, that's not the case.
No.
And I was told that happened because of something that goes back to the 1900s, where, in fact, there was a governor who was convicted of selling pardons. And it's a remarkable story. I mean, but it's an ancient political story.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know that we could look at it now as relevant to the office of someone like Sonny Perdue. It has no bearing on more recent governors.
It's, right.
So, but we have a situation where even if Sonny Perdue was convinced that the evidence should be more closely scrutinized to save Troy Davis's life, there's nothing he could do.
No. No, there isn't. And that, as you said, it's built in for reasons that you discussed and probably others. And the system in Connecticut is the same exact way. The Board of Pardons and Parole has ultimate power to grant stays or to change sentences. And every state does have differences. In some states, the governor does have that authority. But again, it just all points to the fact that, as the Supreme Court of the United States stated in 1972, the death penalty is arbitrary and capricious. It's basically up to a few people to make decisions in a bubble. And that is not the way we want our judicial system to run, because this is the same judicial system that will be the arbiter of my fate when I'm brought before the law for anything, as anybody else would be. And we want it to be fair. We want it to be, justice should be blind. And it is anything but that. And as famous saying goes, those without the capital get the punishment. And we see that time and time again. And when it comes to the matter of life and death, there is no room for a death penalty, and no case screams that louder than the Troy Davis case, because there is strong evidence to indicate his innocence. So in the years that I've been working in leadership positions on this issue, both state, regionally, and nationally, I've never, because we don't work for people on death row. We don't work on cases as such. We work for a principle. And as a matter of fact, as Troy's sister, Martina Correa, who's a good friend of mine, as she said, this case is bigger than Troy. It is really not about Troy. This is about institutional racism. This is about economic advantage and disadvantage. This is about geographic disparity in sentencing laws. This is about all sorts of issues that are not about Troy. It's about the system. And that's what we have to keep in mind. I'm not doing this solely because Troy Davis may be innocent. I'm doing this because it represents a system that is wrought with error, a system that uses capital punishment as a political football, and a system that convicts the innocent and executes them. And I cannot rest my head at night knowing that this is going on.
So the prosecutor who stands to lose if a case is reversed, at least in terms of his reputation, gets to be the one who decides when someone should die. And in this case, that's highly relevant because it means that Davis doesn't have the opportunity to provide new evidence before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Which is true. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court intervention is highly unlikely. That really rarely, if ever, happens. But just even further down the road, if there is any avenue for the presentation of new evidence, and yes, that's exactly correct. Once a person is dead, the case is closed. And in Georgia and in other places, prosecutors, in some states, judges, hold elected positions. And we are in election season. And you know, that has to be looked at as well. Why is this being rushed right now? Why is this being pushed through right now? Because it's a political issue. And because of the overwhelming amount of evidence that would indicate possible innocence, this case has received tremendous attention. And because it's received tremendous attention, it has made people tremendously uncomfortable. And then you throw in the fact that, tragically, this involves murder, and the person who was murdered was a law enforcement officer. That adds to the political pressure to expedite the sentence and put this behind us prior to election season. And that should not be.
You know, if any sort of murder took place right now, and it were being investigated, and someone came forward and said, I saw someone do it, or I heard someone say that he did it, it might be investigated. But here we have that happening before a board of parole, which actually has the ability to provide clemency. Mm-hmm. And yet it made no difference.
And whereas I am passionate in getting that message forward, that you know, we have compelling new evidence and testimony, from their point of view, they're looking at it from the other side. They're looking at it from the point that Troy Davis has been convicted. A full jury has heard the complete trial, not just the sound bites that both sides can present at a hearing. It has gone through its appeals process. And with an imminent execution, people may be saying things just to make sure he's not killed. And so there's that, and this is what you were referring to before, there's a difference between evidence produced at such hearings and evidence produced at trial, and there is a legalese sort of distinction between those two, as there should be, because obviously on the eve of a state-sponsored murder, people are going to be more emotional and more passionate, and so therefore the evidence must be looked at with, I guess, a little bit more skepticism. However, with the Troy Davis case, you could be as skeptical as you want. The fact is, all the evidence, everything is making sense. All the new evidence, the new testimony, which is not so new, as you said, but all the testimony explains exactly why things happened the way they did and the way the system works, or in this case, doesn't work. And it is this grand convergence of all these factors that seem to be taking shape to end in the state-sponsored murder of Troy Davis. And that is what the Georgia Board of Pardons and Parole must recognize. Unfortunately, to date, they are more skeptical than I would like them to be, because I have sat through those same hearings, and of course I have prejudice towards the new evidence. But it is absolutely, unbelievably compelling to hear things such as the man who was assaulted say that Sylvester Coles was the one who hit him, and the one who hit him was the one who shot Officer McPhail. It doesn't have to be much clearer than that. And these are people who have nothing to gain from this. And when things like that are heard, I think that's enough doubt to stop an execution.
Why not give him clemency based on, you know, good behavior and taking into consideration the lack of evidence?
If you look at his life, prior to this incident, he had a clean record, and since this incident, he has had a stellar record in prison. And he continues to be a model uncle to his nieces and nephews, a loving son and brother to his sisters and brother and his mother, and he is productive in prison. He is actually a participating society member within his small society in prison. And so the idea of clemency based on him being a good person holds merit. The gravity of the case seems to outweigh that in the eyes of those who are passing final judgment.
You're saying that meaning that the gravity of the killing of Officer McPhail?
Correct. And the enormous pressure being applied from that side of this debate. There is huge pressure as we are advocating for clemency. There is huge pressure coming from the side of the prosecution to end this case once and for all by the 23rd of September and to move forward. And the pressure is strong on both sides.
Robert Nave of the Amnesty International Program to Abolish the Death Penalty and the Connecticut Network to Abolish the Death Penalty, in his dissenting opinion in the matter of Troy Davis versus the state of Georgia, and a hearing regarding a motion for a new trial that was defeated by a slim margin. Dissenting Chief Justice Sears wrote that the Davis case, quote, illustrates that this court's approach in extraordinary motions for new trials based on new evidence is overly rigid and fails to allow an adequate inquiry into the fundamental question, which is whether or not an innocent person might have been convicted, or even, as in this case, might be put to death. Justice Sears went on to write about the matter of witnesses who recanted their trial testimony about seeing Troy Davis at the scene. He said, quote, if recantation testimony, either alone or supported by other evidence, shows convincingly that prior trial testimony was false, it simply defies all logic and morality to hold that it now must be disregarded categorically. In this case, nearly every witness who identified Davis as the shooter at trial has now disclaimed his or her ability to do so reliably. Three persons have stated that Sylvester Coles confessed to being the shooter. Two witnesses have stated that Sylvester Coles, contrary to his trial testimony, possessed a handgun immediately after the murder. Another witness has provided a description of the crimes that might indicate that Sylvester Coles was the shooter. Chief Justice Sears concluded, Troy Davis deserves a new trial to present evidence in this case to avoid the state execution of an innocent man. And we're going to be turning to this story again on Monday between 3 and 5 p.m. at FM 91.7 WHUS Stores. You can go to my website, talknationradio.org, for further information. And on Monday between 3 and 4, you can tune this program in again at whus.org if you're online, or at FM 91.7 for those within our listening range. I'm Dori Smith. Finally, once again, it's Amnesty International USA, the webpage amnestyusa.org/Troy Davis, for those wishing to fax letters of final appeal on behalf of Troy Davis. And after sending letters, you can also call the Board of Pardons and Parole directly at 404-651-6671, or use cell phones to spread the word. Text Troy to 90999. Other information on how to help with calls and letters is available on my website, talknationradio.org. You can also, for a direct line to Troy Anthony Davis's webpage, put the words Troy Anthony Davis in your URL banner, troyanthonydavis.org. And we hope we won't be reporting on the death of Troy Anthony Davis during our time slot Wednesday at 5 p.m., our best wishes to Mr. Davis, his sister, and the entire Davis family.